Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 9 of Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. My name's Hugh Lemmy, I'm a writer and author.
And I'm Ben Miller, a writer, a researcher, and member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
So last week we covered the Sultan of the Delhi Sultanate, Qutbuddin Mubarak Shah. Who are we talking about this week, Ben?
Well, today's subject had a multi-hyphenate name and a multi-hyphenate resume. In his 55 years of life, he was an adventurer, a geologist, a spy, a dinosaur scientist, one of the founders of paleobiology, the world's first airplane hijacker, a founder of the field of Albanian studies, a cosplay artist, and a murderer.
They don't make men like they used to.
They don't. This is another entry in our eccentric aristocrat series. Born in 1877 in Transylvania, the Baron, here's a name for you, Franz Nopcsa von Feljo-Szilvas.
Try and say that again.
Franz Nopcsa von Feljo-Szilvas.
Oh, impressive.
He may have been, except perhaps as a pub quiz answer, lost to history, but in his lifetime he had an outsized impact on several scientific disciplines, the politics of several European nations and nationalisms, and unfortunately the longtime secretary who he lived with until a murder-suicide ended both of their lives.
Ding, ding, ding. Longtime secretary alert.
Exactly. So Robert Elsie translates and reproduces the following April 1933 article from the Viennese newspaper, the Neue Freie Presse. Quote, as we have already reported, the 55-year-old lecturer Baron Franz Nopcsa shot his longtime secretary.
Sorry.
Ding, 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 ding. Shot his longtime secretary, the 45-year-old Albanian Bayazid Elmajdoda, yesterday morning in his fourth-story apartment in house number 1 of Zingerstrasse 12, and then committed suicide at the desk of his study by shooting himself through the mouth.
Oh my God.
Nopcsa seems to have prepared the deed carefully. A number of sealed messages of farewell were found, as were a sealed will addressed to a Viennese lawyer and several other documents. That material motives may also have been involved can be deduced not only from testimony that his maid had not received her salary for 4 months, but also from the fact that Nopcsa, who was devoted to his books and collections, had been planning to sell off his extensive library containing many a unique volume.
That's like a classic male murder-suicide thing of, you know, running out of money, dignity,
exactly.
kill your partner and kill yourself.
It is, and that's what he does. So the man whose life would end in such notoriety was born on May 3rd of 1877 at the family estate in Jaxal in Transylvania. His father, Alexius, had fought against Mexican independence in the Imperial Army and later became an administrator at the Hungarian Royal Opera in Budapest. His uncle and godfather was a member of the court of the Empress Elizabeth, and so Franz was schooled in Vienna at the Maria Theresianum, which was one of the premier elite schools of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Uh-huh. When he was 18, his sister, Ilona, made a discovery that changed his life. She was out for a walk by a river near the family estate, and she saw an unusual skull, and she decided to bring it home. Now, this happenstance discovery proved to be of major scientific importance. Franz looked through books available to him and was unable to find a match for the skull, and so he sent the skull to a paleontologist by the name of, get this, Dr. Seuss. Professor Eduard Seuss, to be exact, at the University of Vienna, who was one of the world's leading paleontologists. And Dr. Seuss wrote Franz back and told him that this was very interesting and he should sort of figure out what this was on his own, and if he wanted to come study with him, he could. So this auspicious start began his career in paleontology. Franz became a pupil of Dr. Seuss, and he began to study geology, physiology, anatomy, and neurology as part of his complete paleontological education.
Paleontology is a study of...
The study of dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
Returning to the site where Ilona had found the fossil, Franz began more... extensive excavations and discovered more fossils. And he pioneered what was then a new technique, which was comparing fossils to living animals to understand what the missing pieces, the soft tissue that doesn't get fossilized, might have looked like.
Okay.
So you can think about the ways that soft tissue like muscle and tendon lay on and related to preserved bones by looking at how the bones are similar to bone structures that we see now, mm-hmm. and yeah. thinking about how things might have looked. So at the age of 22, he delivered his first public lecture in Vienna, and there he announced his new discovery, which was what the skull was, the Telmatosaurus, or the swamp lizard, which was a 5 meter long and 2 meter tall duck-billed herbivore.
Wow.
So this and some other discoveries made Knopcho one of the world's foremost paleontologists. He was analytically, as I said, ahead of his time. He analyzed crocodile bones and looked at bird behavior for clues as to how dinosaurs might have parented. He insulted scholars whose work he thought was inferior, and that was most scholars. and he got away with it because, A, he could self-finance his own research, and B, his own work was quite brilliant. One crucial paleontological argument that Knopcho made, and one where he ended up being vindicated after his death, had to do with smaller dinosaurs. Dinosaur finds until this point had tended to be spectacularly large, like vast apatosauruses, you know, the smallest things the size of a horse. And a lot of what Knopcho found was much smaller, the size of a crocodile, or even smaller than that. A lot of people were convinced at this point that all smaller dinosaurs were juveniles. Knopcho's proposition was that there was actually a lot more size diversity than anyone knew, and he was able to prove this theory, or to test this theory, by cutting slices out of fossilized bones and examining their cell structure under a microscope. And sure enough, the animals he found had bone structures consistent with maturity rather than juvenilia. In other words, they were adult small dinosaurs, not baby big dinosaurs.
So he's really smart when it comes to, you know,
yes,
he's really pioneering.
He's a good
scientist.
Good paleontologist. And this field of dinosaur bone dating became known as paleohistology, and Knopcho was one of that field's pioneers. He drove forward the art and science of making broad-based arguments about animal behavior from relatively small amounts of bone. David Weishampel, who's a paleontologist at Johns Hopkins University, was quoted in a Smithsonian Magazine article about Knopcho thusly, quote, "Islands are unique places where biology gets a free hand. Large animals tend to get smaller, for example, the dwarf elephants of Malta and hippos in the Mediterranean. And small animals tend to get larger, like Komodo dragons, boas, and tortoises in the Galapagos," end quote. Knopcho realized that, using geological study, that the area of Transylvania where he was doing his digs had been, at the time that these fossils were created, an island. And so his theory was, he called it island insularity, that animals' body sizes change based on food availability and predators on islands.
Mm-hmm.
And that is still something that scientists talk about. They talk about now the, quote, island rule. As Paul Barrett puts it, he's a dinosaur researcher at the Museum of Natural History in London, quote, "If you go to islands today, it's a well-known phenomenon that some large animals have become smaller and some small animals get larger. But Knopcho was the first person to make that intellectual leap and to suggest that this process could also be seen in the fossil record," end quote. He was also someone who pioneered looking at sex differences in dinosaurs, thinking maybe that dinosaur specimens that were different from one another, not only because they were different species, which was what most people thought at the time, but that also two related seeming fossils could represent different dinosaur sexes, right?
Okay.
He also was a pioneer of the theory that dinosaurs were like birds in that they were social animals which cared for their offspring while they grew up and raised them. It wasn't until the 1980s that the field of paleontology moved towards what's called the theory of parental care in dinosaurs, a great name. but Knopcho was there in his work much, much earlier. Now, Knopcho's first great love, dinosaurs, led him to his second great love. You want to guess what it was?
Flying?
Albania.
So
the study of paleontology and his determination to bring together various different kinds of available sources, including geological records, to determine what kinds of lives ancient dinosaurs had lived, eventually brought him to studying the geology of the Northern Balkans. And it was research into the tectonics of the Western Balkan Mountains that first took him to Albania. So he immediately became fascinated by the culture of Albanian tribesmen. And actually, his first boyfriend was another Transylvanian count named Louis Draskovich, who shared his interest in Albanian rural communities. Does he, you know, have an interest in Albanian rural communities?
Is he a Transylvanian count?
With an interest in Albanian rural communities. Now, for an Austria-Hungarian of its time, Albania was perceived as a wild frontier. It served as the border between Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, and its citizens were both imperial subjects and also Muslims, and their rural culture made them an object of cultural fascination. Gezim Alpian, a scholar at the University of Birmingham, argues that, quote, "For a student of dinosaurs, Napsha's initial visits to the Balkans, and particularly to Albania, were inspirational and enlightening, mainly because Albania, especially in its northern regions, seemed to have frozen in time, hibernating for centuries. With its, quote, wild, uncivilized landscape, laws and customs, Albania and the Albanians must have been, in Napsha's eyes, something of a sleeping dinosaur," end quote. We've spoken a lot on this show about bad gays becoming fascinated with peoples and places that they thought were stuck backwards in time. Perhaps this was linked to sex radicals' desire to identify places and times where the kinds of sex gender systems that constructed them as mentally deficient or pathologically ill had been different. This kind of research could undermine modern sexual morality's claims to be eternal, and with it, that morality's sticking power. If things were once different, they might someday be different again. And if things were once different, if humans had not always organized themselves into the same kind of family units, then heterosexuality's claims to eternal superiority could be more effectively challenged. Beginning in 1907, he began to publish in the burgeoning field of Albania studies. And given the country's strategic location, this studies was an imperial science dedicated to cataloging and documenting the geography and culture of that country.
Right, useful.
For that reason, the imperial court ended up financing a lot of his Albanian adventures. But his aristocratic upbringing also helped. If he didn't get adventures paid for by the court, there was always family wealth to fall back on. Robert Elsie has translated Napsha's diaries of Albanian travel. And from the beginning, the diaries are characterized by a dual attitude, right? On the one hand, there's a sort of love for the Albanian people and landscape. And on the other hand, a lot of dismissive commentary about political backwardness, corruption, and violence. And like so many primitivists and ethnographers, Napsha delivered his readers a people ripe for colonization and consumption and reform. To quote from the diaries, quote, "Reforms were constantly being introduced while I was in Skopje. Nothing characterizes the situation better than the fact that despite all the reforms, an Albanian placidly informed the Vali, Shakir Pasha, that he would gladly murder 10 men for him. All he asked for in exchange was a 10-shot Mauser pistol," end quote. Now, as Gezim Alpian argues, the memoirs, quote, "abound in conceited and often arrogant remarks about contemporary Albanians who were trying hard to save their country as the terminally ill Ottoman Empire was finally dying," end quote. Napsha's travels to Albania were taking place in a geopolitically tense and complicated time. Balkan nationalisms and independence movements, the same movements that would help spark the First World War, were in high gear as he began his journey. The Balkan states were trapped in two plurinational empires that were both in what ultimately turned out to be terminal decline, Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, neither of which would outlive the First World War. Before the First Balkan War, which occurred just before the First World War, independent Montenegro and Serbia served as buffers between an Austria-Hungary that included present-day Croatia and an Ottoman Empire that included major portions of contemporary Bosnia and Albania. Assembled and competing nationalisms began to unify under the banner of defeating the Ottomans. And so before the First World War came the Balkan Wars of 1912 to 1914, in which the Balkan League of National Movements overthrew Ottoman rule in the Balkans. Now, Franz Napsha ends up earning a PhD in geology in 1903 by mapping his family estate. But at this time, he was also beginning to suffer from what was at the time a somewhat mysterious condition. Nowadays, it seems like we might think of it as being related to bipolar, based on the information that's available. So he would go through periods of intense productivity and self-confidence. And these would then be followed by periods of with depression, of withdrawal from social contacts, from intellectual work. And he referred to his own condition as shattered nerves. And again, we're talking about a time when the vocabulary for mental illness is very new and it's changing. And there's often both elite and popular conceptions of mental illness as a moral failure or a grotesquerie.
And there's a lot of risk of things, you know, like incarceration, voluntary incarceration, things like that.
Exactly. Not that, you know, we've overcome all of this, but it's just important to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
So someone who is interested in geology definitely had the ability to be useful in a border region, but Nopcsa's interest in Albania began to take a quite obsessive turn. He started spending most of his time there in 1906 and stayed until the 1914 outbreak of the First World War. And he spent some of that time working as a spy, serving the Austro-Hungarian regime to report on local nationalist movements. But in 1906, he met a tall, dark, and handsome young man who he hired to be his private secretary.
Very nice.
This was Bayazid El-Majdouda, and the two really seemed to have mutually hit it off. Nopcsa noted in a diary that Doda was, quote, the only person who has truly loved me, end quote.
Oh.
And for his part, he showed his regard by naming a species of turtle after Doda.
Oh.
I guess that's what you get when scientists love you. So they end up crossing the Albanian Alps over and over again, tooting around on a motorcycle, with Nopcsa publishing dozens of articles and books and really pioneering. And here I really mean the colonial implications of the word pioneering, mm-hmm. the field of quote unquote Albanian studies. Gert Robel, quoted by Robert Elsie, has this to say about Nopcsa and his Albanian fetish. Quote, if we look back upon Nopcsa's life, we can observe the many and extremely diverse aspects in his being, including many a contradiction. His ingenious intuition was in stark contrast to his inability to understand and appreciate the motives of others. His insensitivity and egoism were in contrast to his devotion to the Albanians, his critical intelligence to his emotional bias. End quote. And fetish really was the word here. Nopcsa's journals are full of breathless evocations of Albanians and their honor culture. Here's a story. Quote, this is from Nopcsa's journals. I was deeply impressed by an episode which occurred in the Chem Valley near the Tamara Bridge in Kelmendi country. I had asked for a glass of water at a house, but instead of water, the head of the household, whom I did not know at all, gave me a bowl of buttermilk, which I drank to the very last drop. I had just finished drinking when the brother of the homeowner, also unknown to me, happened to come home. As it was evening by this time and he was tired from his long journey, he asked to have some buttermilk. All that he found, of course, was an empty bowl. When the owner of the house told him who had drunk all the buttermilk, he was not upset, as one might have expected, but rather happy and relieved that I had reached the house before he had, because his family had thus been spared the shame of letting guests depart without having offered them something to eat. End quote. Nopcsa also describes with great admiration witnessing a man take tea with the murderer of his son and saying nothing because they were both guests in a third party's house.
It's like, I guess it's kind of hints there of this idea of the quote-unquote noble savage.
Oh, certainly.
There's this like highly dignified sort of culture that comes in more simple cultures.
Absolutely. That's where it comes from. Yeah. And this interest was able to coincide, as it did with so many of our colonialist bad gays, with a rather cold-hearted promotion of the material interests of his home country. So Gezim Alpian offers the following assessment. Quote, Nopcsa is a typical example of the early 20th century Western scholar whose interest in Albania was ignited not simply out of curiosity for this exotic spot that was gradually emerging from the five-century-long Turkish eclipse, but primarily by the interests of his own country. Nopcsa was not an independent tourist traveler, nor was he a Byronic hero who sided with the Albanians because he wanted to help them to win their independence and establish an Albanian state. Nopcsa was throughout his involvement in Albania more of a volunteer on behalf of Austria-Hungary than of the Albanians, end quote. And he points out, Albion does, that at one point Nopcsa dismisses Ismail Kemali, who is an Albanian independence leader, as a traitor to the cause and as a fraud, based on essentially unsubstantiated gossip. So Napsha at this time ends up beginning to do what I can only describe as Albanian cosplay.
Okay.
So he starts dressing up like an Albanian and traveling to regions of the country that very few outsiders had ever been to. But he's dressing like an Albanian most of the time. In 1907, he and Dodo were actually kidnapped by the bandit Mustafa Lita. And here's a quote from his memoirs of being kidnapped. Quote, "We slept well in Uzmisht. The houses are of the kula type, all at some distance from one another. In Vila, we found kulas that were built closer together, and in houses made of rubble with no whitewashing. In Uzmisht, I learned something of their habit of going abroad for work. On the way to Vila, we met some men who were on their way to pick up a bride. They recognized me as a foreigner, but Mahmud stated that I was his Mik guest, and that quelled suspicions. The wedding procession soon went its own way, and we observed it from the distance as it stopped in front of the home of the bride. After numerous volleys of gunfire, the men of the processions entered the house, had something to eat, and took the bride with them. This is different from the custom in Retsch, where no one enters the bride's home. Mahmud accompanied us to Vila. Traveling in Albanian costume is much better than in European dress. First, the people don't stare so much, and secondly, it's much easier to make contact with the locals. Mahmud turned back just before we reached Vila because he was party to a blood feud there. There was a beautiful mosque in Vila, and yet all of the inhabitants were robbers. However, they did not rob in their own village. Order must reign at home. Mark was sent in advance from Vila to Kalis to inform Mustafa Lita that we were on our way, and returned from Kalis that evening. When we got to Kalis, I was drenched because of the pouring rain as I had been the previous day. My clothes soon dried beside the open fire. Mustafa Lita was a portly fellow, but agile and quick in his movements. He seemed quite muscular. He had a large gray mustache, always entered the room with large, forceful strides, and hastened to take his seat, during which time all of the rest of his men rose to their feet. He was promptly served by his men. One of them took his socks off, and another brought water for him to wash his feet. Another man handed him his meter-long pipe and cigarettes, and someone else gave him a light. Mustafa Lita was taciturn and looked quite confident without having to say anything. He had large, steel-colored eyes that revealed little of his thoughts. The only indication of what he might have been thinking came from his intonation and gestures. He was not a calm person, but was not overly agitated, simply decisive. There was something rather peremptory in his conversation. The reason I am endeavoring to describe Mustafa Lita in such detail is that he was one of the most dastardly robbers of Dibra in all of Turkey at the time. He reminded me of descriptions I had read of Ali Pasha Tepelena, the ruler of Janina. I told Mustafa Lita that I had come to help him fulfill a wish of his, without referring precisely to what I meant. Mustafa Lita then revealed that he had asked the abbot to get him the position of a bimbashlik, army major, but that Hussein Hilmi Pasha, the inspector general of Macedonia, had presented it. We then conversed of matters of little importance. Soon thereafter, we washed our hands for dinner and a table was brought in for the food. Mustafa Lita sat down at the table alone and broke the bread, distributing the pieces. Everyone else in the room waited at his place for Mustafa Lita to call them to the table. Mustafa Lita ate quickly, and the evening was well spent. End quote. I could really get a sense there of his attitude while traveling, his eye, and the way that he's sort of thinking about and perceiving the Albanian people that he's with.
Yeah.
Mustafa Lita ended up deciding he was a spy, probably correctly, and taking him to the town of Prizren, where he then had to be rescued by Doda's father. So his boyfriend's dad showed up with 10 armed men and got him out of it. Now, in 1912-13, in the First Balkan War, Albania wins independence, and there's a meeting in Trieste called the Albanian Congress of Trieste, and this is sponsored by Austrian authorities to discuss a provisional government and to decide who should occupy the throne of an independent Albania. Now, the idea is that a Central European noble family is going to provide a king to be a constitutional monarch.
Right.
And the idea here is that we're prying territory off of the decaying Ottomans and sort of adding it to Europe.
Hence, it being sponsored by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So the idea of independence is
complicated. That being said, there's a lot of independence leaders who are participating there. Okay. Like, independence leaders strategically allied themselves with Austria-Hungary at this time. At least some of them, just as a way of getting out of the Ottomans.
Yeah, a guarantor of freedom.
Well, a guarantor of something. Now, Nupcia has an idea about who should be king, and wait until you hear it. Quote, at this moment, this is again from his diaries, sort of memoirs. Quote, at this moment, I resolved to take a step which could easily have made me a laughingstock and put all of my activities on behalf of Albania in a bad light. Could have, right? Nonetheless, I decided to go through with it. I informed Excellency Conrad verbally that I would be willing to join the list of candidates for the throne if the foreign ministry would support me, and told him that to have myself proclaimed King of Albania, wait for it, I would simply need the one-time payment of a large sum of money in order to buy the support of the so-called Albanian patriots.
Wow.
Once a reigning European monarch, I would have no difficulty coming up with the further funds needed by marrying a wealthy American heiress aspiring to royalty, a step which under the other circumstances I would have been loath to take. I was sure of the support of the inhabitants of the northern part of the country in view of the stance I had. End quote.
Like, what an asshole.
So the plan is that the Albanians, he loves them and they're great and they have this amazing culture, but they're also stupid and corrupt and all they really care about is money.
Yeah.
So he'll buy off their loyalty, be loyal to the Austrians, and then he'll pay the Austrian money back and pay for the governing of the country by marrying a rich American lady who just wants to be queen of Albania. And then, I guess, keep living with his longtime private secretary on the side.
Well, you know, it's a career.
Unfortunately, Dota would not be able to bear him heirs, but maybe some kind of arrangement could be made. I don't know. Now, this, you'll be shocked to hear, doesn't work out. So he continues in the diary, quote, my candidacy may have been ridiculed in competent circles.
Do you think?
Be that as it may, I grew disgusted a few weeks later when withdrew from all further activities concerning Albania. Some of those in the know said that I only did so because my highfalutin plans had not come about. I, for my part, gave as my reason for withdrawing my candidacy that the Albania created by the Conference of London was a stillbirth. I did not even attempt to contradict the slanderous allegations which my opponents reveled in, because I knew that events to come would prove to be my best defense. The collapse of the Albanian state in 1914 showed I was right to get off the sinking ship in time in 1913.
But he didn't want to get off the sinking ship in 1913. He wanted to become the king.
My only quote-unquote mistake was to have recognized what was to come long before my opponents did. he wrote a letter at this point saying, my Albania is dead.
What a prick.
So during the First World War, he ends up falling much deeper into spying. He went undercover in his native Transylvania as a shepherd. But in 1919, the Hungarian Soviet Republic declared its independence from the Austrian throne in the aftermath of the lost First World War. This was a 130-day-long Soviet state. It was quickly abolished and became the Liberal Hungarian Republic. But remember, this is 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, right? The path of Germany is still somewhat unclear. It is a bad time and place to be an aristocrat with ties to the old regime.
Yeah.
And Nupcia was stuck in the Hungarian Socialist Republic with Doda. And he needed to get out, so he hijacked a plane and flew it to Vienna.
Wow. Okay.
And this is the first recorded airplane hijacking in history. The loss continued as the aftermath of the First World War played out. Transylvania was ceded from Austria to Romania after the Treaty of Versailles, and with it went his estates and his possessions. And so suddenly, for the very first time in his life, Nupcia had to actually earn a living.
Yeah.
But lucky for him, he had a qualification as a geologist. And geologists are the kinds of people who can always find work. So he became president of the Hungarian Geological Institute. And you'll never guess who was employed there as a secretary. But like so many aristocrats forced to work, he quickly became bored. So he quit his job out of boredom. He took a motorcycle trip around Europe. He returned to Vienna deeply in debt. He then sold his fossil collections to the Natural History Museum in London, where they're still on display. He did that to pay his debts. And at this time, his health and his mental state became increasingly fragile. He did manage to complete the memoirs that we've been quoting from here, but they remained unpublished until 2001 in German, which he wrote them in, and then they've been translated much more recently. Many of his ideas about dinosaur evolution, writes the paleontologist Gareth Dyke in Scientific American, have turned out to be true. Quote, "The dinosaurs of Transylvania will most likely prove critical to understanding the global distribution of dinosaurs just before the zenith of their diversity, 65 million years ago, a heyday cut short by a cataclysmic asteroid impact that extinguished their kind," end quote. Like the dinosaurs, the eccentric aristocrats of Europe were extinguished in the 20th century. By 1928, Napsha was frail. By 1933, he needed to deliver his lectures in wheelchairs. He delivered his final lecture in spring of that year to the Geological Society in Antwerp, but even with a high fever and lecturing from a wheelchair, he was still speaking extemporaneously and captivating a packed hall. But he was increasingly poor and depressed, and so that April, he drugged the love of his life, shot him, and then shot himself. Quoting from his suicide note, quote, "The reason for my suicide is my nervous system, which is at its end. The fact that I killed my long-term friend and secretary, Mr. Bayadid Elmasdoda, in his sleep, without him having an inkling as to what was going on, was because I did not want to leave him behind sick, in misery, and in poverty, because he could have suffered too much. He was cremated in Vienna, and his ashes were buried there in Zimmering."
You're listening to Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history, and we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you, and that's why we now have for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gays, and that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture, but we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month, we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with, episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of bad gays, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gays, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgayspod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgayspod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show.
Thanks, Ben. What a fascinating, weird, diverse, sort of like almost cartoonish sort of life.
Yeah, I really want a TV series about this. I think it would be a really fun period piece.
Yeah. In terms
of anyone who wants me to write it, can feel free to get in touch. BenWritesThings.com.
In terms of his relationship, what were the sort of prevailing attitudes around homosexuality in Albania, if it was this sort of border state between these two cultures, who I guess quite different in some ways, sex gender systems?
So that's an interesting question. There's an article by Stephen Omari in the edited volume Islamic Homosexualities called Male Homosexuality in Ottoman Albania that kind of gets into social attitudes. So the Ottoman Empire had abolished its sodomy laws in 1858. There was a fair amount of writing in anthropological and ethnographic sources at the time about kind of various kinds of pederastic traditions in Albania. The German scientists writing in the mid-19th century about young men between 16 and 24 loving boys from 12 to 17 and then getting married and kind of giving it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of fits into certain kinds of Islamic traditions that we've talked about. But again, it seems to be much more, what was going on there seems to be much more in the kind of like pederastic and age differentiated tradition than in a kind of equal tradition.
Yeah, like men of the same age and social status.
Yeah, there was one person that Murray quotes talks about, quote, "a permissive attitude to male homosexuality, particularly when shepherds were away from feminine company in the hills," end quote.
The Brokeback Mountain theory of sexuality.
Exactly. A bareback mountain. And bottoming after eating a can of beans, braver than the troops. Back to the subject at hand. But situational homosexuality, pederastic traditions, kind of all understood by European observers as part of this kind of primitive or barbaric...
Despotic East.
Not really despotic in the kind of Orientalist sense. I think it's what's going on here is much more primitivist, actually.
Okay.
In terms of
mountain people
and, rough border region bandits, etc. Yeah. And Albania is also a tradition of depicting Albanians in European culture as kind of sensual, erotic, but also very foreign, alluring but somewhat barbaric.
Yeah, there's this concept of balkanization, a different form, not balkanization as we understand it, but the Europe ends sort of, the Balkans begin when the next country across.
Yeah.
And regarding this being the first plane hijacker, he stole the plane. What were the consequences of stealing a plane back then?
Well, because he stole the plane from the hated Hungarian Socialist Republic.
Okay.
It was kind of chaos. I mean, it's a 133-day Bolshevik Republic, right? So there's kind of a lot of chaos in those 133 days in Hungary in 1919. He just sort of stole it to get out and landed it in Vienna and never returned. I mean, he returned to Hungary when he was president of the Hungarian Geological Society, but this was after that regime had collapsed. Yeah. And so you're talking about, liberal countries are not particularly interested in prosecuting property rights claims against elites who stole things in order to escape from brief communist
situations, especially at
that time. Yeah.
And in terms, you've mentioned throughout this idea of, of course, the lifelong, the sort of long-term personal private secretary. Do we have any evidence about the nature of their relationship?
We do. What's interesting is that on the one hand, you have someone who's really – I mean, one of the reasons why he's interested in Albania is probably this kind of reputation for primitive – quote-unquote primitive tolerance of male-male sex, either situational or pederastic. But it seems like his relationship with Dodo was neither situational nor pederastic. Dodo was slightly younger, but they were both very much consenting adults.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't buy him. The two sort of stuck together, right, even when Nopcsa lost his money. It's not like Dodo was just sort of sticking around because he was being paid and then left as soon as there wasn't any. He seemed to have been sort of genuinely devoted to one another.
When he refers to him as the only person who ever really loved me, is that, do you think that's in a sort of similar way that you would like that gay men might say that today about their partners? Or is that sort of almost like this Lawrence of Arabia thing with his boy of the sons?
No, they were boyfriends. They were very much boyfriends, and it seems to have very much been a mutual relationship from what I can tell. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not to say that, he murdered him in the end, right? So I'm not saying that this was a great relationship where everyone treated each other well, but, it was a real relationship, at least at some point.
And in the field of paleontology, it was interesting he seems to switch almost from paleontology to geology as he grows older. You mentioned that some of his opinions were sort of unorthodox at the time and only, in the late 20th century became adopted. Was he sort of forced out of the world of paleontology for those beliefs, or he just changed his...
No, he just got really interested in Albania, although he never really changed completely. So he actually continued lecturing on paleontology throughout his life. Last lectures were on paleontology. That was what he was best known for.
Mm-hmm.
Geology was another thing that he worked in. That's where he found the job, because geology is obviously an extremely important science for economics and for production and mining and all sorts of things. So that's why that was the job he was able to get. But he was absolutely still interested in paleontology and active in paleontology and lecturing on it until the end of his life. Yeah.
Wow. What a fascinating man.
Yeah.
So on that note, what do you think of him in terms of, the classic judgment we make at the end of the podcast? Good gay, bad gay, not good gay, not bad, bad, not gay?
Definitely gay.
Yeah.
Longtime private secretary. And I think anyone who murder suicides their boyfriend is pretty definitionally a bad guy, and in a very classic kind of patriarch murder-suicide way, right? Like, this is exactly the way that patriarchs act when their authority is challenged, right? And when they feel like they can't provide. It's an extremely, like, classic, I mean, to almost minimize the behavior by using an overused phrase, but like a very sort of toxic masculine behavior.
Yeah.
Obviously someone with an extremely interesting life story, and someone who is extremely like dashing and compelling and, you know, in a kind of be gay, do crimes way, kind of fun to think about.
Yeah, I agree on that. So if people want to learn more about him, what are some of the sources you used for the episode?
Well, there's a couple academic articles. There's his diaries, which have been published, are available on JSTOR. There's another article by Robert Elsie about Napsha. Elsie also translated the diaries. And then there's that article by Gezi Malpion. Then there's some stuff about his paleontology in Smithsonian Magazine and on the website of the Natural History Museum in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then an article on crime reads about skyjackings, and then some other Albanian history sources. They're all cited in the show notes.
That's great. Thanks very much. Well, that's the end of our episode. You'll be listening to Bad Gays. My name is Hugh Lemmy. You can find me online at hugh.substack.com.
And you can find me on the internet at benwritesthings.com and at benwritesthings everywhere. Till next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bad gays. Bad gays.